When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I am Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, Brian Reese.
Hey, Paul.
Today on the program, in addition, first of all, I think both of us are sweating our collective somethings off because it's really hot.
Yep.
Yeah.
In different parts of the country, no less.
So
it is August. So this isn't exactly, breaking news.
I guess. But if you hear things in the background, that's me putting all my fans on because, boy, it's hot. Anywho, today on the program, we'll be talking about the Flintstones, the 2016 12-issue miniseries that is completely family-friendly. Nothing really to talk about. But before that, Brian and I have decided to just, there's been a lot of comic book TV shows out recently that there's just been so many. And we just want to do a little quick recap of our feelings on them.
Well, I mean, my goodness. I mean, they hit us all at once. I mean, once The Boys ended, I mean, then we get like Miss Marvel, we get Sandman, we get Paper Girls.
Yep. Umbrella Academy.
Harley Quinn, Umbrella Academy.
Yeah.
It's if you're a funny book fan and you also like the TV machine and you like your funny books on the TV machine, this has been kind of a golden couple of months.
Yeah. Unless you're a grump,
then you just, if you're like an incel, but
If you're a grump, that does nothing but complain about this glorious golden age we have.
You know, comic skaters go to comic skate.
Yeah. I'm an older guy, and man, I would have loved this as a kid. You know, back in my day, we had garbage on TV.
Well, we really did. What are you talking about, man? We had Yo-Jo, G.I. Joe, and we had Transformers, and we had G.I. Joe, and we had Transformers.
Well, there was He-Man.
We had Thundercats and He-Man.
Both of which, I would say all of which, have had better revivals today than they were back in the originals. And
at some point, the Thundercats was terrible.
Yeah.
Ooh, we're gonna get some hate mail on that one.
It really was. And He-Man was terrible.
Oh, my God. Was it entertaining as a kid? Sure. But anybody out there who is like, oh yeah, He-Man was the pinnacle of cartoon. No, you're wrong.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
And I might even like deign to get on Twitter to fight you.
And there's, there was that Spider-Man TV show, which was awful. And there was Captain America TV show. Well, there was TV movies and they were awful. And I know people love the Hulk series from Bill Bixby Hulk thing. It's not that good. Guys.
No, it's not that good. It's not. And yeah. I'm sorry, but even Wonder Woman, Linda Carter will always be the most iconic Wonder Woman. But if you watch the show.
Yeah. I mean, I love Linda Carter, though.
Oh, so, yes.
Yeah, I give it a pass.
This is a Linda Carter safe space.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, today's television comic book stuff, it's just glorious. It's so good. Even when it's not good, it's still pretty good. So anyway, let's talk about modern TV comic book adaptations. Let's start with Ms. Marvel.
All right.
What a cute show.
It's fantastic. It's great. Are there some narrative lapses here and there? Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a couple of things that happened. I was like, that's, random. But it's a fun comic book, and it's geared towards a younger demographic,
right?
More of a teen kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's good. I think it's good that they have these shows and they're not all for me.
Yeah. 50-year-old dudes bitching about Miss Marvel, take a seat.
Exactly. But I'm not going to, because this is one of the shows, just how they incorporate social media into the show. That can be done very clumsily.
Yeah, and visually it did it. It was great.
Yes.
But the movement and the, I mean, it's good filmmaking. It's just good filmmaking.
Yeah. No, I love the way that when they're
creative,
when they're texting to each other, it becomes part of the environment that they're walking through. It gives you the visual impression that when you're on social media and you're out in the world, everything becomes one.
Right.
It was just really well done.
And it moves with you. And the performances are great. I mean,
can't remember her name right now, but who plays Kamala Khan?
Right.
Goodness gracious, she's just adorable.
And yeah. It also featured probably my favorite segment in all of the Marvel TV, the current Marvel TV history. And it's the Bollywood wedding.
Oh, yes.
Which was sheer joy.
Absolutely. That dance sequence is great.
Joy personified. And anybody who's going to like shit on that, just go away.
Yeah. It's fun. Look, comics should be fun and comic book shows should be fun. I'm not saying you can't have some dark elements. I'm not saying that there can't be something serious to it. But overall, comics give out a sense of joy, if you understand what I mean. It doesn't have, I mean, I'm not talking about it's frivolous or anything like that, but that needs to come through in the show.
And I think that Ms. Marvel did a great job of conveying that. And I just think it's incredibly well done. Is it the most important of the Marvel series? Okay. I mean, whatever. Did I have more fun watching Ms. Marvel than I did WandaVision? Yeah, I did.
Okay.
It was WandaVision like a stunning piece of work? Absolutely. But, you know, and Loki, you know, but which of the shows have I like just smiled through more than any of the other shows? Probably Ms. Marvel.
And I, you know, they did change her powers a little bit in the show, probably because there's going to be a Mr. Fantastic soon. So I don't know. Guess they didn't want to give similar powers, but I like what they did with it. It still gives you the impression, the same feeling that the comic books have, except it's more crystal stuff, which is probably easier to render on a TV budget.
Sure.
So anyway, I had a lot of fun with that one. Like I said, how you had phrased it, there are some narrative missteps along the way, but I'm willing to give it a pass because most of it is just so much fun to watch.
So, I mean, but we've got like, you know, Ms. Marvel, Harley Quinn just dropped. We're only four episodes in, but it continues to be wonderfully irreverent. We've got Harley Quinn. We've got, you know, the Umbrella Academy, which I finally just finished up. And that's just a hoot.
Yeah. Talk about starting off with a dance number. Episode one, the very first scene. I turned that on, and as soon as I got into the dance scene, I was like, okay, you got me.
Yeah.
I'm here.
It certainly gave Peacemaker a run for its money in terms of dance sequences.
That's true. Have we talked about Peacemaker?
We've been
inconsistent recently, but Peacemaker's been great. Harley Quinn is another show that it's irreverent, it's foul, it's bloody, but there is a sense of joy that comes from it. Because it's a lot of fun in a gruesome kind of way.
And the best representation of Bane ever.
Absolutely. And the best representation of Clayface, I think.
Yes, true. And King Shark, to be honest. I mean, yeah, King Shark, Bane, Clayface. I mean,
I actually like Kite Man.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, he's from a previous season.
I think everybody likes Kite Man. I mean, we're all rooting for Kite Man, aren't we, at the end of the day? I mean, I know Tom King has given Kite Man some love.
Now, what we need is a accurate, positive representation of Stilt Man. And I think with Disney Plus doing a whole slew of Daredevil coming up, I think we might get a good Stilt Man.
I will be curious to see how he is represented with CGI rather than animation.
Okay, so I want to get into this in a second. It has been mentioned a couple of times on this show that Brian's favorite character is Daredevil. I think you've brought it up once or twice.
Yeah, I mean, definitely one of the top two.
Okay. Disney Plus now has the Netflix shows airing on, have been brought over with Charlie Cox. And Charlie Cox's portrayal of Daredevil has now been brought into the movies.
As yes. Nick,
spoiler if you haven't seen this movie, but he appeared in Far From Home, the Spider-Man movie, just as lawyer Matt Murdock. And he's going to be making an appearance in She-Hulk, which
we're given to understand.
He's in the trailer with his glorious yellowness.
Love the yellow.
Yes. And he's going to be appearing in Echo, another Disney Plus series with Kingpin, Vincent D'Onofrio's Kingpin. And then, of course, not till 2023, or is it 2024?
I don't remember, but he's back.
Yes, we're going to have Daredevil Born Again, an 18-episode series of Daredevil. Brian, how do you feel about Daredevil getting so much love, a Daredevil cinematic universe?
Great, because I love Charlie Cox's version of Daredevil, and I think it's weird, 18? I mean, I think Daredevil is, obviously, as you stated, I'm one of the top members of his fan club. I write letters to the fan club regularly, I have my Daredevil decoder pin that I got from. Anyway, it's great, and you know, I think we've touched on this before, and the fact that every single writer in comics dreams of writing Daredevil. I don't want to speak for all comic creators, but I mean, let's be honest. He has consistently gotten the best writers to write him, and with varying degrees of success. The 18 episodes seems like a lot. That's weird because we grew up with the 22, 23, 24 episodes a year of our TV shows that we watched. I always felt like, you know, the A-team probably could have done with less episodes. You know, 18 seems like a lot. And by that, I mean the shorter format, the generic 6 to 10 episode story arcs have obviously become more popular in recent years. And I feel like that works on some level because you're not forced to fill in empty space.
Right.
I mean, look how terrible the CW shows have become over the years, with the exception of the Legends of Tomorrow.
One of the greatest shows ever made.
Canceled Legends of Tomorrow. Meanwhile, Flash just limps along. Oh my God, just kill it now. well, we're going to get another season. We don't get another season of Legends of Tomorrow, but oh good Lord, we get more Flash. So that editorial aside, when you have these 20 episode stories, that works for like Law and Order, but you know, it just, that seems like a lot. And I hope I'm wrong. Yeah. I hope I'm wrong, but 18 episodes.
Yeah. Well, maybe the way I see it,
when you hit 10 on a show that I really love, because I was like, oh, it's only 10 episodes. I have to wait a year for, or 2 years or 3 years or 4 years for the next round. But then there's part of me that is like, well, they told their story, no filler. They got in, they got out. So I'm curious what they're going to do with 18 episodes.
Well, my thinking on this is, first of all, Born Again is a very dense story. There's a lot going on. I don't know.
Well, they kind of already did Born Again.
Yeah, but they did it on Netflix. That doesn't count. I have a feeling that they're going to do it a little bit more fateful. No pun
intended. Which is not going to rest easy for casual fans who love a certain character. Who love a certain character in the original Daredevils.
True.
You love Karen Page, spoiler alert, if you love Karen Page, you may not want to watch this Born Again.
Well, they can make adaptations and maybe someone else will. Anyway, I have a feeling that they're going to really, really do a faithful adaptation of that, which means there's a lot of character work and psychological baggage that needs to be unpacked, which could lead to more episodes. And I also think, I was making a joke about the Daredevil cinematic universe, but it's kind of true. So I have a feeling that there's going to be a lot of things brought up in, say, She-Hulk and Echo and probably other shows that are going to bleed into this, so that maybe there'll be side quests or a larger narrative. 2 years is a long time in an interconnected universe.
Right.
For a lot of storylines and a lot of narrative threads that need to be tied up. So I could see where 18 episodes could be justified.
And if there's no Jessica Jones, I'm throwing an internet fit.
I think they'll put some Jessica Jones in there. No talk of Iron Fist. I'm kind of surprised.
No talk of Luke Cage either, but I'm going to assume Luke Cage will make an appearance as well.
Yeah, I think Finn Jones got a bad rap.
Yeah, it's not the actor's. It wasn't the actor's fault.
It's like, well, let's give you no training and no lead up to this.
He was, with the material he was given to work with, he was fine.
Yes, he was fine. And season two is way better than season one.
Yeah.
But that's not a high bar to pass. Yeah. So anyway, I think they'll probably do Iron Fist again, but I don't think we'll be seeing Finn Jones anytime soon.
No, probably not. Although we could be surprised. He'll be in the first episode of She-Hulk for all we know. Surprise. And by the, of course, the time this comes out, we will already know this. I would like to add, we didn't touch on this yet, but Paper Girls is phenomenal. Well done. Oh. All folks involved with that. They changed things around a little bit. Seems like fans are mostly okay with this, particularly since it was with Brian K. Vaughan's blessing. But Paper Girls is highly recommended. And no, neither of us have started Sandman yet.
Yes. Yeah. Sandman, as we record this, Sandman just dropped yesterday.
Yeah.
Or, I don't know. It's been recent enough that I haven't had a chance to see it yet. Yeah, I'm probably not going to do a 10-hour binge myself. I actually really enjoy having week-to-week episodes again.
Yeah, I'm actually more of a fan of the dropping one episode a week.
I really enjoyed Umbrella Academy. I think I enjoy the show more than I do the comics.
Yeah, I probably enjoy the show more than the comics.
Yeah, the comics are fine.
I love the art in the comics, but...
Anyway, the TV show is just a lot of fun. I love the actors in it. It's just a really good show. However, when you binge, you just sort of get lost in a while. I kind of like having an episode, digesting it for a while, and then seeing a second episode. Now, you don't have to binge.
No, you could watch an episode every week. I think with something like Sandman, though, with that coming up, I feel like with other shows, I'm okay. But with Sandman, I think I'm just going to have to carve out a day and just do it. Because, you know, what happens is you finish an episode and you're like, I'm going to be disciplined and I'm going to wait to watch the next episode. Except how many of us are that disciplined?
Yes. You don't open up a bag of chips and say, I'm just going to eat two.
Right. No.
You know, you got to eat handfuls.
I guess we'll see.
Anyway, I guess in conclusion,
in conclusion, you have to do the debate team hand gesture.
Which always works well on a podcast.
Yes.
Hand gestures. Anyway, yeah, I just really like that we have so much to choose from as far as comic book media, visual media. Well, I guess comic books are a visual media. What am I saying? TV. There's so much comic book TV shows, superhero stuff. And it's great. And even if you don't like something, there's another one to watch. It's wonderful. Right. I don't know. I don't know what fans want. Everyone just seems to be complaining.
Nobody's making you watch it.
Yeah. Everyone just seems to want to watch stuff and complain about it.
Yeah.
I would rather like something. I don't know. It's much more entertaining to me.
Yeah. And if I don't like something, then I just move on. Or I'll just save my anger for a podcast.
We very rarely. We are always trying to do the more redemptive reading of things. Right. And I prefer that over just shitting on something, basically.
Yeah, we've had a few.
Yeah,
sometimes something is just so irredeemable that we just have to talk about it and maybe have fun with the fact that
even Beauty and the Beast, we found something good to say about it.
We did?
Yeah, we did. You should listen to our show, Brian. We're pretty good.
I should probably listen to this podcast sometime.
Yeah, we have interesting things to say from time to time. Anyway, good things are good, and I like liking things.
Yes.
On that note, let's take a break, and when we come back, let's talk about a modern Stone Age family.
Yes, indeed.
The swamp, more than merely a place. It is a churning, seething, bubbling bed of life of which you are a part. Once you were a man, a chemist named Ted Salas, until one little experiment went somewhat awry. and you changed. The serum that was to have made you a super soldier combined with the strange forces in the swamp to make you over into this, a shambling, mindless mockery of your former humanity. The macabre Man-Thing.
Man-Thing was created in the early 1970s to capitalize on the growing monster craze, but under writer Steve Gerber, it became something quite different. Experimental, surreal, and very, very weird. It was something I loved as a kid, but does it still hold up today, 4 decades after its initial publication? So join me, Paul Matthew Carr, as I attempt to make sense of this cult classic and analyze each issue, putting it in the context of the time it was written and comparing it to the standards of today. And maybe you too can come to love the world's second most famous swamp-based comic book character as much as I do. The Nexus of All Realities, a Man-Thing podcast, a twice-monthly dive into the bizarre.
And we're back. So, Paul Carr, today we're going to discuss your recommendation, and you recommended a fascinating comic book. You recommended The Flintstones. Would you like to tell us about it?
I do. Flintstones. Meet the Flintstones. They're a modern Stone Age family. From the town of Bedrock, they're a place right out of history. The Flintstones began as the first ever primetime animated TV show in 1960, and it ran for 6 seasons. It was a spoof of sitcoms of the time, heavily inspired by the Honeymooners, and it based its jokes on the then burgeoning suburban culture that had been growing in post-war America. It relied heavily on pop culture jokes, celebrity parodies, and puns. Just so many puns. Originally intended for a family-friendly audience, the show was suitable for kids, but also snuck in enough satire and double entendres to keep the adults entertained. For the time, The Flintstones was pretty cutting edge in its satire, and its skewering of current events and culture was spot on. But inevitably, in time, that satirical edge was blunted, and the references became quaint or the meaning forgotten to subsequent generations. So much so that The Flintstones became a fixture on Saturday morning cartoon blocks and mid-afternoon reruns. It was used to sell cereal and vitamins, and their faces adorned lunchboxes, t-shirts, and onesies. In short, The Flintstones became a kid's property. A property where politics and sex have no place, and it was a bastion of pure, clean goodness. A wholesome place, a place of innocence and charm, where the woke agenda is mercifully absent. And then in 2016, writer Mark Russell and artist Steve Pugh came along, not only to throw that notion out the window, but to tear it into shreds and stomp on it a few times before doing so. In this 12-issue run, Russell and Pugh reimagined the Flintstones. This reimagining was more realistic, in that the character designs were less stylized and given more human proportions, and its situations and attitudes reflected a sensibility that's more modern, for lack of a better word. In it, we find the Flintstone family and their neighbors, the Rubbles, living in a newly constructed town of Bedrock after a questionable war. They're struggling to adjust to the alienation of their new way of life while trying to come to terms with a haunted past. And along the way, they encounter the various repercussions of living in a society. This book pulls no punches. Everything is on the table. Politics, sexuality, religion, corporate greed, war, genocide, PTSD, consumer culture, and the crippling depression of suburban malaise all are fair game. It's not afraid to tackle the existential dread of existence while at the same time critiquing the exploitation of the working class for the rampant profit that benefits a tiny minority. It asks questions like, what is marriage? Is there a God? And if aliens contacted us, would they be party bros? And that's the best part. It's funny, really funny. It has witty banter, great one-liners, and puns. Just so many puns. And although the topics being satirized seem current, the Flintstones comic arguably does justice to the original series by embodying its spirit and intent better than any spin-off or repackaging has in 50 years. The original cartoon subtly held a mirror up to society, pointing out its flaws and absurdities by imagining modern life as the Stone Age. The Flintstones comic does the same thing, except this time, there's no subtlety. In conclusion, Flintstones, read The Flintstones. You'll have a gay old time. Brian, what did you think of The Flintstones?
I think what is interesting is satire is tough. satire is it can fall flat more often than it can sting with barbs. I go back to Mark Russell, and Mark Russell is a very fascinating writer. Mark Russell has written what was my favorite comic of a few years ago in the Snagglepuss Chronicles.
Yes.
And he's written comics like Not All Robots, which I think is also great. But there are times with Mark Russell where some of his comics leave me a little cold, where subtlety is not strong. So I approach this. I didn't read it. I remember reading about the Flintstones, and I never picked it up until you recommended this. So I hadn't read the Flintstones until we read it for this. So I approached it with an interest based on some of the things I had read before, particularly some of the things written about the appliances, which we will get into, which had interested me. But all of this to say, my first read through of this, I think the first six issues, I was kind of like, some of it works, some of it doesn't. And as I got further on into the comic, I was like, this is really good. And then when I went back to do the second read, some of the things that irritated me about the first half of it, I was able to contextualize in terms of what happened later in the comic. I don't think that everything hits. I think that there are moments in it where the satire is a little too obvious and on the nose. But I think that when Mark Russell is hitting the spot correctly, which is 90% of the comic, I think it's quite fantastic.
So I'm kind of in the same place as you, except I think, yes, there is no subtlety, but I think that that's intentional.
Right.
Because this is such an over-the-top parody, the satire is over-the-top as well.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, there's so much being, there's so many topics, there's so much being thrown at you. That, yeah, it's not always going to hit.
Right.
Even if half of it hits, it's still pretty hard hitting. You want to say it that way?
I would also like to say that it boggles my mind. And I think I said this to you when I first started reading it. I am astounded that this comic book was allowed to be published by a corporate entity for a full 12 issues.
Allowed to be, not just DC, because DC has a tendency to do some pretty subversive stuff.
Right.
But Hanna-Barbera allowed, and again, you mentioned the Snagglepuss series. That's another one that's just incredible. I don't know if Hanna-Barbera, when they did their, their deal with DC, if they said, yeah, do a Flintstones cartoon, but make it very offensive and deal with the hardest topics imaginable.
Right. And it's not just the Flintstones, the whole Hanna-Barbera thing that they did, had the Jetsons was about climate change and destroying the earth.
I haven't read the Jetsons, so good to know.
And for the record, we should have stated this from the beginning. This week, George Jetson was born.
I heard that. Yes.
It won't be timely by the time we post this, but somebody did the math, and George Jetson was born sometime this month or within the last few weeks.
So we actually get to meet George Jetson.
Yes. Anyway, it's apropos to, the discussion of the Flintstones in terms of Hanna-Barbera and kind of this. So I did want to mention that in passing. But I think there are things going on in this comic that are quite surprising, and I will get into those. So my misgivings on some of the comic being a little just, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, we get it, okay, thank you, that is way outweighed by some very sharp observations.
Yes, absolutely. Again, Mark Russell's not trying to be, to sneak one by you. When he has a point to make, that point is very sharp, and he jabs you with it over and over again. Yeah, there is no nudge, nudge, wink, wink. It's, look at this! Look at this!
Steve Pugh's art, I love Steve Pugh in yeah. general, but his art is just spot on. And all of, we have to give him credit. I don't know if this was in the script or if this is Steve Pugh going rogue, but the level of visual gags going on in the background, out of this world.
Just the, you know, like I said in the intro, just so many puns.
And the visual puns alone, just the you know, and again, I don't know whose job it was to name the businesses.
They did a great job.
I have just a list that I'm not going to run down, but I kept a list just for our discussion of the names of stores. Really well done.
I will throw out my favorites, which are Plato's Cave, which just, you know, philosophy guy. Whammoth, Bammoth.
Well, that's also that's a very adult reference too, but go
yes.
on.
Yes, Whammoth, Bammoth, thank you, Mammoth. And the Outback Snakehouse, which is just good.
Yeah, the Outback Snakehouse is good. Homo Erectus is great too.
Yes. There's so many. Every page you could just look it over and just there's something. Someone's wearing a t-shirt or there's, visually, it's amazing. Steve Pugh outdid himself with this. And it's surprisingly, you know, I mentioned the more realistic looking characters. It's still right. It's still highly stylized, of course, but.
Right. It's cartoonish, but Fred and Wilma and Betty and everybody, they're presented as like humanoid.
Yeah.
Not the kind of squat. I mean, they're drawn in a human comic style as opposed to a comic style. Yes. I should say a cartoon comic style. They're not drawn as cartoons. They're drawn in a human comic style. Does that make sense?
Yes, it works surprisingly well. It actually, I think the more realistic style gives some of the heavier issues some more weight.
Back to the titles, it's like one of my favorites is Bedrock Gravel and Loan, which is a nice
yes
callback yes. to It's a Wonderful Life. And there's a few things in there. There's one in particular that I love. That we'll get to, but
yes. So each of the 12 issues, kind of, there is a narrative arc, slight narrative arc to the story.
Well, there's a story that carries through, and it's the sort of the evolution of Bedrock, right, and the evolution of some of the characters within Bedrock, and the individual issues kind of show subtle changes, but then when you read the whole thing, you see like character arcs continue. People learn lessons, Paul.
People do learn lessons.
There's learning that happens.
Yes. You could say that a lot of this is very cynical. However, Mark Russell does seem to have he has a hopeful outlook.
Yes.
That's the only thing that's subtle, is his hope.
And even with the hope, it's like you see it burgeoning. You don't see it early on, and like I said, that's part of where I had, but as it continues forward, and even to the point where you have Las Vegas or La Vega, Las Vega. The planet where you see the odds of human survival changing.
I was actually surprised to see the Great Gazoo and aliens show up as early as they did in this. That's episode 2, I believe. Or three, episode three, issue three. So like there is a story arc that kind of goes through this, but for the most part, each issue is a standalone story where we get, you know, and you get to meet all the side characters. So I'm reluctant to go through this issue by issue.
But, well, I don't think we can really issue by issue. There's, I mean, I think issue 9, the issues in the issues. I mean, I think issue 9 is probably my favorite, and it's also the saddest. Or not? No, it's not the saddest. There's sadder, but well, one of the things I do want to point out is I think what is interesting is there are only really two characters, maybe three. Let's say three characters that have what I would say are important story arcs in terms of their that change or that show change within the three of the main characters, the ones that we think about the most. I think that Barney and Betty are inconsequential, and I think that's on purpose.
Yes, Betty especially.
Betty is meaningless. I don't want to make that like as a sexist thing in terms of, and I don't think Mark Russell meant that to be. I think that's a reaction to how she is treated in the show as well. Yeah,
and also I think it's a reflection of Betty and Wilma aren't friends. They're just sort of, they're the wives of their husbands who happen right. to live next door to each other. You know, in society kind of throws everyone together and it's like, well, now you should be friends because you have, you know, you have a mutual acquaintance. But that's not always the case.
Right.
It's like, you know, we just kind of live next door to each other and we're friendly and there's no animosity, but we don't really hang out.
And I think Barney is just a moron. I mean, he's presented as just being dumb as a rock throughout the entire thing, no pun intended. And and I think so his character doesn't really have a strong.
Well, there is the war orphan.
There's the war thing, but I think
the finding of Bam Bam is pretty significant.
The finding of Bam Bam is pretty significant. We could get to that, but I think that let's just talk about the main characters or the people who think about the main characters for the moment, because there is another character that I think has the biggest story arc of, or the biggest, we'll get to that in a minute.
Bowling ball.
It's bowling ball.
Yeah.
We are on the same page here.
Okay.
Fred and Wilma have fascinating stories, and the way that they grow as characters is very important. And the way that they react to the world is unexpected based on the expected characterizations of them from the cartoon. Mr. Slate has a massive character arc throughout this, of all people.
And his relationship with Philip is
kind of touching.
It's heartwarming. Yeah.
Philip is his turtle assistant.
Turtle butler kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
So those are the three of the characters we know.
I would throw Pebbles in there too, to a lesser extent, but she does have a sort of.
Pebbles is awesome because she's like, but she starts off like kind of like the shit. Right.
Yes.
This is a family show. But no, she's like, she's the questioning, rebellious character who in the end gets the answers.
Yes. Well, she has, she has that conversation at the end with Reverend Tom, which is interesting. I don't know if I technically agree with the Pollyanna attitude at the end, but we can get to that.
Right. We could get to that. But I think what Russell does is, so you have what I would say the three, we'll include Pebbles, but I think Pebbles is like smart and interesting from the get-go. And so she gets some of her feelings confirmed as opposed to changed. But the biggest characters in this are the peripherals. And again, it's bowling ball and it's vacuum cleaner. And which, I know
if you haven't read this,
this sounds like I'm having a stroke and just saying random words.
Yes. Now, if you know, if you're unfamiliar with the Flintstones, part of the conceit of the show is that it's the Stone Age, but they have modern conveniences. However, those conveniences are performed by various animals,
living creatures.
So the coat rack is a moose,
right,
obviously, and you know. And there's a bird who's a lamp, and an octopus is the dishwasher, and so forth and so on. And two of the characters are a baby elephant, which is the vacuum cleaner.
A baby pink elephant,
yes. And a bowling ball, which is an armadillo. And they have the best relationship. They have a tragic story.
And it's now I'm not going to say I teared up at any point reading this comic, because obviously I would not, because I'm a very manly man, but if I were to have teared up at any point, it may have involved bowling ball and vacuum cleaner.
And the resolution to that story is when ShopVac comes in, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's deal with, I think, Fred and Wilma and we'll get to,
and I just wanted to add real quick, the fact that Dino or Dino. Is it Dino or Dino? Do you say Dino or Dino?
I say Dino.
You know, I say Dino too. Is the savior of all the world, even better. But okay, sorry.
Yes, and the Great Gazoo, or Game Warden, as it's translated in his language. Another really, I mean, I always thought the Great Gazoo was a kind of a ridiculous character for the cartoon and had no point, but he actually has a point in this.
So I'm sorry. Let's go to, this is your recommendation. Let's talk about what you want to talk about.
Yeah. Well, let's just start with, okay. So the backstory of this is that all the people, the cavemen, were kind of hunter gatherers living in this world. And then Mr. Slate comes along and has this great idea of paving over this one area and creating a modern society. But in order to do that, the people living in that area have to be removed.
The tree people.
The tree people.
AKA the other.
Yes. So they are presented as evil. Maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves. It starts with Bedrock already being established. It's a right. new society. People are kind of learning as they go of how to, you know, to live in houses and then a mall is built and they have to get jobs. It's a parody of our suburban lifestyle.
And then consumerism is a massive part of this.
Consumerism as a substitution for actually going out and being a hunter or a gatherer. Mm-hmm. Instead of doing that.
All of these things addressed in the comic. I mean, he does a great building up of like where they go from hunter and gatherer to consumers. And there's a long discussion about, you know, is the hunters are the prized ones as opposed to the gatherers. And that's a very interesting aspect. But yeah, sorry, go on.
Well, yeah. So kind of coming to terms with this new, how to live in this new society, including the invention of religion, having to go through several gods before they finally settle on the one that they're actually going to worship.
Right. Gerald,
which eventually gets abbreviated.
Which eventually gets abbreviated in a, what should be like kind of an obvious joke, right. But it kind of works because he even included a sexual joke with the, anyway, go on.
Yes. So we start with Fred at his job working for Mr. Slate in the gravel quarry, where his job is, it's kind of funny. He has to break up rocks and then he gets paid in broken up rocks. And he feels inadequate. Basically, this is all about the exploitation of the worker. And, how do you want to say it? Capitalism sucks.
Well, yeah, I mean, this comic does not, is certainly not going to be used in pro-capitalism textbooks.
No. As far as being anti-capitalism, it gets high marks.
Oh!
Oh, hello.
Oh, boy.
It's summed up, actually, in the first issue, we get the, there are Neanderthals who are brought in as unskilled workers that Mr. Slate is trying to get them to do the job for less money. Lots of stuff happens, and the Neanderthals decide to the heck with this. They're going back to their old lifestyle. And one of them says, "It seems to me the point of civilization is to get someone else to do the killing for you."
Oddly enough, I have that in my notes and quotes.
Yes. Which, again, this gets back to this isn't subtle. This is the first issue, and that is the point of it. And along the way, we start getting the fact that Barney and Fred actually fought in the war.
Right.
The
war, or a war.
A war.
A war happened.
And they go to little meetings where they discuss their feelings. Is it in this issue or the next issue where...
It is in this issue because they actually take the Neanderthals to the meeting because it's on the way to go to the fights.
That's right.
Right. So they're supposed to take these Neanderthals to a boxing match, but they have to stop off at... veterans of the Paleolithic Wars.
Yes. A support group where, you know, they talk about, it's PTSD. They all have to deal with PTSD.
Right. And they're given... Well, and it's one of the non-funny parts, right? I mean, right. So we don't know the context of what war they fought in at this point. Yeah. What we do know is that Barney, Fred, and all the other men of the town who fought in this war that's being referenced are having severe issues coming to terms with this war they fought in. And we find out what happened later.
Yeah. So what? Yeah. So they had to clear the area to make bedrock. So in order to do so, they had to get rid of the tree people, and the tree people were given a. They were seen. They were demonized.
They were the other. They were the other. It's the.
You know, we have to destroy them before they destroy us. They're going to ruin our way of life. So they.
But of course, it turns out that the tree people had no interest. I'm just going to skip ahead because narratively, this all, even though these are, this happens over several issues, I think narratively we could just talk about the whole thing right now, right?
Yeah, let's just do that. Yeah.
So, you know, to war. I mean, this is like right out of the Marx, but this is right out of Duck Soup.
Yes, indeed.
And it's Ginning or right out of W. Bush or whoever else wants to like start a war to, anyway.
Yeah, we have to fight them there so that we don't have to fight them here.
Right. So they essentially a because, like you said, Mr. Slate wants to build bedrock. This is pre-bedrock. And then Mordok the Destroyer or whatever his name is comes in and... You know, he is like, we must kill the tree people. And so because they're threatening our children, you know, and what about the children? They essentially a war party, like they Fred and Barney sign up. They go through basic training. There's, you know, I mean, we've got Full Metal Jacket going on. We got all this other stuff going on.
Yeah, sorry. There's one at reference where there's this huge kind of jungle gym looking thing. And they say, we can't climb that. He's like, no, this is what you need to learn. And they burn it down.
Right.
And I thought, oh, burn the village to save it. That's just awful. Yeah. Anyway, so I'm sorry.
The whole point is to take out, and, you know, this also has like Native American aspects to it. Yes. So the whole point is that Fred, Barney, and all of the other male, and it's all males, are conscripted into war, and they go to fight the tree people. And they basically commit genocide. They completely decimate and destroy all of the tree people who had nothing to do with anything. It was ginned up.
Yes, they actually, at one point, in a very tragic type of scene, they have this big battle with the tree people, and they find children's toys. So they find out that they just destroyed a village of families.
And Fred says at one point, he finds the doll, and he's like, we've been lied to. Who brings their children to an invasion? And the other important part of this is, speaking of bringing children, has a low sperm count and can't make children. And so at the end of this, after Fred is like, they brought children to an invasion, we've been lied to, Barney finds a baby. Mm-hmm. And that baby, of course, and then he brings it home to him and Betty. And this is one character growth thing that I think Barney and Betty have. They bring the child home and raise the child. And of course that child is Bam Bam.
So war orphans and genocide.
Yeah.
What a good times. What a funny story.
In a comedic, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of the thing about this comic is that it's ridiculous and it's ridiculous and it's just over the top and it's crazy. And then suddenly it gets really serious. Yeah. So then, you know, bedrock is created from the ruins of this war. Society begins anew. Or begins for the first time, not anew. And we get the building of a mall. And everyone is encouraged to go out and buy crap. As much crap as you need. And it's literally called crap. Just buy as much crap as you need. And so we get into overcompensating. They're actually buying more crap than they need and more crap than they can afford. But you have to keep buying crap because if you want to stay hip with society... You just got to buy as much crap as possible.
And, you know, this introduces us to Power Goat.
And we get the vacuum cleaner for the first time.
Right. Well, and the whole, this devastating scene, and this is what sets up, I think, some of what happens later with bowling ball and vacuum cleaner and appliances and whatever is, you know, and it is so Fred gets Power Goat, you know, which is what was Power Goat, a lawnmower?
No, it's like a weed whacker. So it's a goat strapped to a stick.
Right. It's a goat strapped to a stick.
And you just, he just swings it back and forth in front of his lawn.
And so like at some point, right, Fred returns Power Goat. He's like, I'm not going to use this. I don't really need this. He finds out, well, he doesn't find out, but we find out. So Power Goat gets put in the back, and what's happening in the back is terrible. So it's a return. He takes it back to the returns at the local JCPenney.
I think it's JC Pebble, isn't it?
Yeah, but there were some. Yeah,
yeah. But yes. So if an appliance can't be resold, it gets recycled.
Right.
Which means
appliance returns equals meat.
And you see later there are commercials for, you know, dog food made from completely recycled meat. As funny as this comic can be, sometimes it's just horrible. The implications are horrible.
One of the things that happens when he returns Power Goat, you know, they bring out a sack of meat and you realize, because he needs food for one of his other appliances, and you realize that sack of meat is the animal he just traded in.
Right. He does, however, get to he gets an appliance that is non-functional, which ends up being Dino, that he brings home as a pet.
Yeah, and that's one of the nice things is, like, you know, I think it's like, you know, he's like, what does he do? And the guy's like, nothing. And Fred's like, perfect.
Yes.
Because Fred is sick of appliances. And so it's Dino. He's the family dog. They bring him in and he becomes the family dog.
Who is seen by the other appliances as Uncle Tom, basically.
Right. And an idiot.
Yes, he is, in fact, an idiot. He likes to run into the TV when he sees something on there.
Which becomes very important later.
Indeed. And then we get to that issue 3 with Is an Alien Invasion. I wasn't expecting that.
Some of the best moments, like funny moments.
Well, we get introduced to Carl Sargon.
Right.
Who has billions and billions of hours ago the world was created.
that's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then he talks about the world, like he says, some people think the Earth sits on the back of a giant turtle.
Yeah.
Terry Pratchett fan in me is like jumping up and dancing around the apartment, right?
Well, it's even better than that, because they say some people think that the Earth revolves around the sun, which is ridiculous. It sits on the back of a turtle that revolves around the sun.
Yes. And I'm just like, anytime we give Terry Pratchett and Discworld a bit of love, that's a good thing.
It starts off with trying to start a space program by launching a chimp into space. And it has one of my favorite little panels. Carl Sargon says, don't worry, his spaceship knows which way to go. To which the chimp replies, tell my wife I love her very much. And someone says, she knows.
She knows. that's so good.
Yes.
So good. And I understand that we might be spoiling it, but visually it's... You'll still, if you read this and you see it, you'll laugh.
Yes, yes.
And that's the
kind of humor that you get in here. It's really silly.
And then the fact that somebody in the background goes, science! And I'm like, that's Thomas Dolby.
Yes. And then actual aliens come down, which are the great Gazoo's species. They came down just to get a listing to put in the Encyclopedia Galactica, to which a bunch of teenagers decide
alien teenagers decide
to have spring break in Bedrock, and hilarity ensues as they start overrunning the town. Basically, again, every issue it talks about corporate culture, it talks about consumer culture, and how the commodification of neighborhoods becomes. So these just rich kids basically come into town and start using people's neighborhoods as a playground.
Right. And then killing them.
And then killing them, yeah. Because
they're just disintegrating people left and right.
This is ultimately resolved by telling on them, like contacting their parents to come and get them.
Right. And that's where the Great Gazoo comes in.
Yeah. And then the Great Gazoo is left there as their game warden to try to, the human's game warden, to kind of be the protector. Of Earth, and it's just, this is just, it's over the top, it's silly, but at the same time, it's still talking about very deep intellectual questions. It's like, it deals with colonization, and just, there's a lot thrown at you, and this is just issue 3, yeah.
Right, and I think but that's the thing, is like, every issue has like these kind of deep moments, and they also have incredible moments that we can quote or reference. Lots of little scenes in each of these issues.
Okay, so listen, we said we weren't going to go through this issue by issue, and now it turns out we are going through issue by issue. Let's stop that and just hit on some what I think are the key points, and then let's finish with a discussion of Vacuum and Bowling Ball.
Sure.
So there's an issue about marriage.
Featuring Adam and Steve.
See, and now this, I think, is great satire, because being monogamous is seen in this society as being a perversion.
Right.
And yes. So Fred and Wilma are married, and they're, you know, they're looked down upon by the society of, oh, great. You let men and women get married. Next thing you know, dinosaurs will get married and so forth. And then, of course, Fred runs into his good friends. Friends he's known his entire life, people he's known his entire life, Adam and Steve, who are a couple. They're non-breeders. All this rigmarole happens. An angry mob is formed. They say, let's form an angry mob. And they yes. Yeah, let's do it. So they try to...
The Westboro church of the Stone Age.
Through a confluence of events, the angry mob sees the error of their ways, and everyone is sort of reconciled to the fact that it's okay. Marriage is fine. We'll let that happen. So then Adam and Steve want to get married. The reverend says, well, no, we don't want that.
Well, wait a minute.
Well, wait a minute. And he ends by saying, I need to think on this, which I probably won't. Yeah. I wanted to point that out because I just thought that's great satire right there.
Yeah. And it's one of my favorite parts. And the fact that it's Adam and Steve is just really a lovely poke in the eye.
And this is where this is the issue where Pebbles is wearing a T-shirt for Nick Cave Man. it should be pointed out that Pebbles has posters and T-shirts of all the current bands of the time, which are
the cool bands.
Yeah, right. They're wonderful. Next, we get a new mayor is elected, who is Claude the Destroyer, son of Mordok the Destroyer, and it is brought up that he's the son of Mordok. He just inherited the title Destroyer, but hasn't actually destroyed anything on his own.
Which means he has a lot of issues and wants to start his own war.
He wants to start his own war with the lizard people.
Right. To impress Daddy.
So he wants to start his own war. And in order to do that, he has to raise money.
Right.
So he gets his celebrity endorsement by Stony Danza to get a children's hospital closed down in order to take that money and put it towards arming the dinosaurs.
Right.
Yeah. Again, this kind of thing isn't subtle.
Yeah. I mean, it's like each issue has its issue. Each issue addresses different sort of thing. So, you know, we can't address every one of these. Mm. Nobody has time for a 6-hour podcast.
Right. But I do just want to point out some of these things because they're funny. But at the same time, they kind of make you shake your head and go, oh, yeah, but that's actually happening. Like during the campaign, Mordok just keeps saying these platitudes and make bedrock great again kind of a thing. And someone just gets up and stands and says, he says the things I wish were true. I guess we have to point out, well, Carl Sargon finds out, does some calculations and realizes that there's an asteroid that's going to hit the Earth and destroy all life. So civilization breaks down completely at this point, and everyone just kind of goes awful. I found this really interesting, this particular issue, just because, you know, it's the end of the world scenario. And right. What would happen at the end of the world? Would everyone just be calm and cool and collected? Or
no, they're losing their...
They lose everything. They lose their stuff. Of course, the
great moment where Fred is eating food from the Panda Express.
Yeah, the Panda Excess.
Panda Excess. Yeah. And the food is a baby panda.
Yeah, God. And during the complete breakdown of civilization, the pandas actually escape from the Panda Excess and start ripping people apart.
Yes.
Yeah. But this is where we kind of get the burgeoning relationship between Bowling Ball and Vacuum Cleaner. Vacuum Cleaner is an elephant, remember, who sits in a closet. Bowling Ball takes pity on him and opens the door, and they become friends.
Well, I think what is interesting is after these first six issues, and we're about to kind of go forward into the final six issues, I think Mark Russell may have the series may have gotten. I think he may have felt like he only had six issues. So when we get to issue seven, is when stuff really gets serious, and this is what you're about to get into.
Right. So we have, the first six issues kind of set the world and get you into the idea of, you know, these are the jokes. This is the humor that's going to be out there. These are the characters. I should also be pointed out that Mr. Slate is, he's incredibly wealthy, but he's also incredibly lonely. So the world has been established. We not just the world inside the comic, but also its tone has been established. The following six issues kind of takes all that and cranks it to 11. So obviously the asteroid doesn't hit Earth. Carl Sargon made false calculations due to moths in the Mothadone Clinic.
The Mothadone Clinic.
To which there is a great quote. Just a random person says, "I hope we can go back to pretending we're good people." And life is a series of mutually agreed upon delusions. Another good quote.
There's so many little great quotes in this, yes. And I've written them down in my notes. Most of them we're not even going to get to, but Mark Russell, really, there's some really deep observations, and I can't believe I'm saying that when I'm talking about a Flintstones comic.
Yeah, in this back half, we also get an explanation of economics. A small-time fraud, that's a scam. When it's so big that people have no choice to participate in it, that's economics.
There's a running gag about raising rent.
Yes, they keep raising. Because Fred's home, or Fred's neighborhood, Fred and Wilma's neighborhood, gets gentrified. Oh, there's a true hatred of hipsters. It's in fact, one of the aliens calls it a hipster slave economy, which, oh my God.
Which in some ways is a little dated. I'm not sure if hipster is a legitimate kind of thing anymore.
Yeah.
And I think Russell shows his age a little bit in the same way that we do. the hipsters.
Yeah. Goddamn hipsters.
Yeah. Hipster hasn't been like a thing for a long time, but
I don't know. You haven't been in downtown Denver in a long time.
Well, that's true, but I live in Chicago.
So this back half, let's rush through this at the end, because we can't go through it. We can't go through it issue by issue. And Essentially what's going on is the aliens are going to judge humanity and to see if they, to see if we're, where there's a neighborhood association, which of aliens.
This is
and
great.
So if anything is doesn't look good in the neighborhood, they'll just destroy that planet.
They blow up the planet. Yeah. So the neighborhood association is, this is where the Great Gazoo comes from Las Vegas, or what is it? Las
Vargas. Yes.
The neighborhood association is this alien race that judges planets, whether they fit in okay with the Milky Way. And there's, again, we don't have the time to go into like the deep structure of what all that means. But yeah, Earth is potentially on the chopping block.
So they're going to be judged. And this brings up a lot of really poignant moments throughout these last six issues. One of which is that a worker that Fred is with gets injured on the job and buried by a bunch of rocks. He wants to find this person to see if they're still alive. But of course, Mr. Slate says it's not profitable. Just leave him and get on with your work. Fred does, in fact, take extra time to unbury this person. And it's a really lovely moment.
Along with his fellow co-workers.
So the workers actually take the time.
The rest of his co-workers are also on board with saving this guy. So it's not Fred by himself.
Right.
It's the community of workers who are invested in saving this one worker as opposed to towing the company line.
Yes. So every life matters, and altruism is what will inevitably save the human race.
And this is noted by the Great Gazoo.
We also get a wonderful moment between Wilma and her mom, who have been estranged for many years. And this is a very long ongoing subplot as well.
Wilma's plot is very fascinating.
Yeah. Wilma had to run away from a egalitarian society.
Yeah, pretty much.
I'm not going to do it justice because it's actually really well done. Mom starts a farm, essentially, which causes a whole bunch of problems as well as solving a bunch of problems.
It's in reaction to the patriarchy and the hunter-gatherer notions.
Yeah, so they start planting, which is trying to get away from the patriarchy, which actually helps enforce the patriarchy. It's, you know, if you're not into this sort of thing, if you're not woke, this probably annoys the shit out of you. But I don't care. It's really interesting.
It's a long piece that is really, that follows through several issues. Wilma's whole story follows through several issues, including how she comes to her art that is fantastic. We can't go into the full details of it. We could, but we won't.
She does primitive art, which is eventually picked up by Werner Herzog. What's his name? Roxog or something? Werner Herzrock. She ends up getting hired by Werner Herzrock, which is fantastic.
But the origin of her art has a wonderful explanation. And I'm not going to tell you what it is. You should read the comic.
Yes, you should read the comic.
Amazing. And I wrote down like a bunch of quotes. I'm not going to quote them. It's one of the more important pieces of this comic, actually. And I feel like we're giving it short shrift, but here we are.
Yeah. Well, and it also plays into the relationship between Fred and Wilma as well. And it strengthens their bond because during the marriage issue, Fred has a very poignant little speech about what marriage means and what his fears are that, again, I'm not going to read it to you, but it made me go, huh, that could sum up my experience with this comic is a lot of it just went, I went, huh. So, and last little bit, there's also Claude the Destroyer wants to start a war with drones, which are just cameras strapped to the back of pterodactyls. That goes horribly wrong. So all this is happening all at the same time. And we're basically getting some great character growth from both Wilma and Fred. Fred especially. Mm-hmm. He comes to the realization that there's more to life than just working and slaving for a living. The real gift is the friends we've made along the way.
but yes, you know, it's...
I'm being flippant, but that is kind of the message, and it's done well.
Well, the whole comic is about the nature of humanity, and there's so much that goes on in each issue that feeds into other parts of it that what have you.
Well, no, it's the exploitation of workers. It's greed as a culture. It looks into gender roles. It looks into the nature of war. It looks into
religion and science in very serious ways.
And that we had alluded to it, but there's a little discussion between Pebbles, who is working for, she's an intern at Carl Sargon's Science Institute, Science Cave, actually. But she's also having troubles with, how does she fit her religion? How does she fit her faith into the idea of science? And the priest has a nice little moral at the end.
Right. I think the priest has, and I wrote down the quotes on that, but I can't find them.
There's also a thing about indulgences where people just pay to have their sins forgiven.
Right. And George Slate is one of those. But I think at the end of the day, redirect me if I'm going the wrong way. But we're working up to two very major pieces.
Yes.
And to me, the first major piece is the salvation of the human populace, or the salvation of the Earth, and the Great Gazoo has some incredible monologues throughout all this thing while he's observing humans, and he keeps changing the odds. The odds start of their survival starts at an astronomical level. And eventually he gets down to even odds. But the one point where the odds collapse down further is when the Home Association, which we referenced earlier, they are the ones. So they're coming to judge Earth, whether Earth is allowed to be a part of the Milky Way or if they're going to blow the planet up.
Yeah. And if they're too much of a threat or they don't like them.
And so the Great Gazoo is very concerned about all this. He's like, you're going to blow the planet up. I don't understand. He's like, we have to give them a chance. What ultimately results is that they come to the planet and they were like, we will take one individual creature, person, whatever, and judge the planet by this one individual creature from the planet.
And Gazoo gets to pick that person.
And Gazoo gets to pick that person. And of course, we don't see which one it is until the very end. But so they bring up the Great Gazoo's representative for the planet. And they're like, oh, well, this species is non-intelligent. They like meat. They're this, that, and the other. They're like, they're fine. They're innocent.
Yeah, they're not a threat.
They're not a threat.
They're too stupid to be a threat.
And so the representative that the Great Gazoo picked was Dino.
Was Dino, who immediately smashes his head. Everybody's
favorite pet. It's exactly. Your dog.
Yeah, he smashes his head into their screen, which is showing a piece of meat. And that's when they say, they're innocent, they're fine.
It's also, because we all know we love our pets, and everybody's pet is smarter than everybody else's pet.
Well, I've had some beagles. You'd be surprised.
But it is telling that the Great Gazoo chose Dino because Dino is the most innocent of every single character in this comic, right?
And he loves unconditionally.
And it's kind of. The cynic in me is like, don't say this, but it's kind of touching.
It is kind of touching. It's innocence will win out. And that is the thing that the message that keeps being reinforced, that even as bad as things get, it's our human connection to each other. It's our innocence. It is our loving nature. It's our altruism. And that is the ultimate, theme of this story is that, just be good to each other. Yeah. And things will get better. I know that sounds simplistic, but I'm kind of on board with that.
Which probably leads us
to the wonderful tragic life of the appliances, specifically vacuum cleaner and bowling ball.
But I think it's all of, so this starts when we see the fact that the appliances are disposable. And as much as like Fred and Wilma and Mr. Slate have their redemptive arcs or have their realizations about things. Only Mr. Slate understands, this is weird, only Mr. Slate understands his relationship with appliance.
He has to come to that realization.
He has to come to that realization.
Because he tries to abandon Philip as his turtle butler. Mm-hmm. It's just weird to say, but... And he does abandon Philip at one point in order to get replaced by something better. And it's and he's also replacing his employees at the same time. So low skilled workers that he can that he can pay less. And he replaces all his experienced workers, replaces Philip, his experienced turtle, with an eagle. It sounds silly. The words coming out of my mouth don't make any sense right now.
It sounds goofy, but wonderful scene where Mr. Slate learns a lesson, and the lesson is debatable, but at the end of the day, he learns a lesson, and he's walking, and there's Philip, and he picks Philip up and takes him back.
And he says, he does say sorry. He realizes that you can't just replace people or things willy-nilly because, they're people.
And to me, it's like Mr. Slate may have had the biggest character change in the comic, oddly enough, because of Philip, which leads us then to what I think is the most important part of the comic.
And that is finally, we're going to get to vacuum cleaner and bowling ball. So they have started this friendship. Bowling ball gets replaced with a new bowling ball, which is just a different armadillo with Fred written on the side of it. And bowling ball gets recycled, to which vacuum cleaner plans a daring rescue.
We should. So previously, though, you know, vacuum. So there's we have numerous panels and sequences with the appliances. So bowling ball is initially bowling ball befriends vacuum cleaner because vacuum cleaner is locked in the closet and vacuum cleaner is a pink elephant whose job is to, we all get it.
There's a trunk there.
So, but there's this scene where, you know, it's just the appliances are all hanging out. The family's gone to bed. You hear this voice coming from the closet, like, you know, asking, hello, is anybody out there? It's dark and I'm scared. Can you open the door? And so bowling ball opens the door and it's vacuum cleaner and vacuum cleaner is, you know, and they talk and they become friends. And again, we're anthropomorphizing all of this, but.
But they do have personalities and they have conversation.
Vacuum cleaner and bowling ball end up creating a relationship.
They have this daring rescue. As I mentioned, the new bowling ball is disposed of, not in a malicious way.
And it's brutal. Like, so because old bowling ball gets thrown out because Fred gets a new bowling ball because he's sad. And so they throw out, you know, the original bowling ball that's friends with vacuum cleaner. And so he gets sent to recycling, vacuum cleaner rallies the troops, meaning the rest of the appliances, and says, we have to go rescue bowling ball because he's our friend. And so it's creating like a relational, like beyond just we exist randomly.
Yeah.
But it's the idea that we exist in a community. We are the community of appliances.
Yeah. There's a whole subculture. Let's just say what it is. They're slaves.
And so, right. So they plot this rescue, and what happens is that they plot their way, they leave the home. It's, you know, a bunch of animals like going and to rescue bowling ball, and they get to the recycling center that bowling ball was sent to, and they finally understand what happens there. And it's a slaughterhouse.
Yeah, they recycle it into food.
Through a series of events, they enter and they find bowling ball and they free bowling ball, and it's Philip the turtle who has been rejected by Mr. Slate, who points them out to where bowling ball is. And then the moose, which is
the coat rack,
the coat rack is just like, you know, coat rack don't play this shit. And he goes back in and kicks open all of the cages and sets all of the animals free,
which allows Philip to be out on the street, which is where Mr. Slate finds him and has
Muppet.
And that's the end of his redemption arc. Real quick, there is also a little subplot of movies are being made, and there's one movie theater in town which plays movies where women bear it all.
Mm-hmm.
So the men have to sneak out and dress in big, you know, overcoats and hide their faces to go see these movies. But it turns out they're all like chick flicks and romantic comedies. So
Magnolia, Ridges of Madison County, Joy Rock Club.
When they say women bearing it all, it's bearing their feelings. And the men have to secretly go and see this. I think that's hilarious.
And this is important
because vacuum cleaner keeps sneaking out to watch these movies as well. And of course, the people, the employees of the movie theater see he's a vacuum cleaner and they make him clean the movie theater, which causes exhaustion, and vacuum cleaner dies. Bowling ball then goes into this existential crisis that his friend just gets thrown away. There's a lot more to it. Bowling ball does his own little mini revolution where he he ruins a bowling game. A bowling game? Is that what you call it?
Which features a female bowling team called the Spare Ribs.
Absolutely brilliant. Yes, but anyway, it all culminates in the fact that Bowling Ball now is angry and he hates life. And he's very cynical until he hears someone in the garage, which is Shop Vac, who's also very lonely. He's a pink elephant living in a drawer. And Bowling Ball lets him out. And they have a very tender moment where they have a little conversation and Bowling Ball loves again. That was the moment where I said, okay, this is really touching. It sounds ridiculous, but it is very, very emotional.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a lovely moment. And it's one of the things with Bowling Ball and Vacuum Cleaner is that Bowling Ball hears a joke. Like, so one of the running things is that they don't know what a joke is. And Bowling Ball hears a joke finally and is excited to tell Vacuum Cleaner about, this is a joke. I finally heard a joke. We could talk about a joke. And when they get back, it's when Vacuum Cleaner has died. And there's a scene where they throw Vacuum Cleaner. It's one of the most devastating panels I've seen in comics, is when they throw Vacuum Cleaner out and they just put him in the garbage.
Yeah.
And in the background is a window. So it's Fred and Wilma throwing him away. And in the background is a window. And in the window is just the shadows of all of the other appliances watching. And it's just their silhouette, but their eyes are lit up. Just brutal.
It is. And I kept thinking, oh, he's going to come back. Obviously, they'll do another rescue again. But nope, Vacuum Cleaner's gone.
Yeah.
But in the end, Bowling Ball learns to love again.
Yeah. And he makes a new friend and he learns. And I think it's a great line where he talks about, when he's talking to Shop Vac. Shop Vac asks him, how did you get to know so much?
Right.
And Bowling Ball says, somebody taught me. And it's just him in a window with the moon over there. It's Steve Pugh, well done. Mark Russell, well done.
Yeah.
It breaks your heart.
It does. But it reinforces the idea of, even at our lowest moments, it's friendship and love. And I know it's cliche that will carry us through. And it's the friends we met along the way. And it's corny, it's cheesy, but it's really kind of beautiful.
It's so well done, and it can stab into the heart of even the most cynical of people. And I think that's like where this comic goes.
Right.
It's a wonderful arc of, Fred has amazing moments, and I've got tons of quotes by him that, where he understands things, he starts to learn things. Wilma gets that as well. Pebbles gets that. George Slate gets that. And actually, George Slate has one of maybe the best monologues, and I might end with that, or at least end my bit about it. With all of the humorous bits, there's a funny bit at the end that is both kind of a sexual innuendo, but also shows us where God comes from. You know, where it's like God doesn't rub, GD doesn't rub it in, GD rubs it out. And that's where God came from, because the church had to, like, it wasn't Gerald. They didn't have enough room to write Gerald. So, there's all these great things. And at the end of the comic, it's like the Great Gazoo narrates the final issue. And he basically says, it ends with him basically saying, even odds. The odds have reduced and reduced, and he's now viewed humanity as even odds to survive. He said humanity is in their terrible twos. They're going to do. There's a lot of philosophy and things involved, but it made me think of this great quote by George Slate, and I'm just going to read it. I hope that's okay, Paul.
No, go right ahead.
It's after he rescues Philip, and he comes back, and he apologizes to Fred Flintstone, and he's kind of coming to terms with the world and things like that. And he says that once you pray to a God of strength, you surrender all right to beg for mercy. And Gerald, help us, we all need mercy. Because in the end, it's only our ineffectiveness and the softness inside us that makes life worth living.
There you go.
And I just, it's, how does a comic book about stinking Flintstones deliver that level of
poignancy?
Yeah.
I mean, let me tell you, I am shocked at how much I enjoyed A Flintstones. I don't know if you recall, back in the day when these Hanna-Barbera comics came out, I was very dismissive. Like, right. Oh, geez, they're going to do Hanna-Barbera crossovers. I bet these are going to suck. And it turns out everyone I've read so far, I've truly enjoyed.
A lot of them are really fun. Even the ones that are just goofy, like the one-offs, the single issue ones.
I am a big enough man to say I was wrong. So this actually was really good. And I love the message that, yes, human beings can do terrible things, but it is our capacity to love and to be compassionate that will eventually save us all. So there you go. I recommend this comic.
Paul and I are having an emotional moment here.
Yeah, people. This is good stuff. So unless you have anything else to say. I think we should find out what it is we're going to listen to. What it is we're going to read next time.
Well, we're really going to up the ante next time. Let me tell you.
Okay.
I think in your intro, you often talk about the infamous, the famous and the infamous, right? Yes. That's our tagline. The famous and the infamous. Well, we might be going for infamous on this one. So my recommendation for our next podcast will be Aztec, the Ultimate Man, written by, wait for it, Grant Morrison and Mark Miller, or Millar, depending on, what your pretensions are. Illustrated by N. Stephen Harris, was released by DC in 1996. There are people who swear that this is one of the greatest things ever written. There are people who swear that this is one of the worst things that have ever been written. Paul and I will get to the bottom of it.
This is actually exciting for me because usually when you recommend something, even if I haven't read it, I know something about it. This comic, I know zero, absolutely nothing about this. I've seen the character pop up in various things like Grant Morrison's JLA run. He has a little cameo, but overall, I'm going in blind. I have no idea what this story is. So it's nice to not know.
But look at the pedigree.
Yeah. Well, there's good and bad.
Yep.
Yeah. It's interesting. Apparently there's some
mark it along enough to finish the comic. Only time will tell.
So that's exciting. I'm looking forward to it. All right. Thanks everybody for listening. Please let us know what you think about the Flintstones. Let us know in the comments at collectededitionpodcast.com, where you can leave comments on individual episodes, or Twitter at collectededitpod. You know the deal. All right. Thanks for listening again. And until next time, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter @collectededpod. That's collected, EDPOD. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained?